Okay, so back in the day, a long, long time ago, I wasn't sheltering in place or on neighborhood lockdown or whatever it is we're doing now. But as unlikely as it seems, somehow, some way, somebody convinced little me to come in from outside playing ball with my buddies, to sit down, to tame my boy energy and watch this movie they had. The Parent Trap. It's all about some bad girls who realize they're twins, they're separated at birth. And they pull a bunch of tricks. And for some reason, they try to get their terrible parents who abandoned them to reunite and be together or whatever. And this film, it annoyed me. Because I was sure these supposed parents probably broke up for some very good reasons. But I guess it annoyed me for another reason as well, because I wanted to do the opposite of the Parent Trap. Like a lot of kids, I figured that my parents might not have been the best match a long time before they figured it out themselves. If they had made a movie instead about how these girls pulled pranks to break up their parents with the quickness instead of drowning it in ages of familiar torment, then I might have given this film my own Oscar. Well, today, instead of my own Oscar, we have amazing stories of real people who take their family situation into their own hands. We're calling it The Parent Trap. My name is from Washington. Little boys, they're like monsters in their movies. When you're listening to Snap Judgment. Now then, ever since she was a child, V always knew about her parents' epic love story. But she never knew the song behind it. Producer Liz Mack brings us their story. Snap Judgment.
My mom had told me that there was a town reunion that was happening in LA, and I had agreed to go. A town reunion is like when everyone from old Vietnam comes together, have a big old party, lots of food, lots of people, and they kind of, you know, relive each other for a moment. My mom was really excited. She really was stoked to see all of the people that she had grown up with. And my dad's kind of like, I don't really want to go. I would rather stay home. I remember pulling up to kind of like classic LA Asian plaza. I think it was a Chinese restaurant. But I remember in the inside everything being like prom, like, this is gonna be hella extra. My mom is, you know, greeting all these people when she's exuding all of this excitement, just like, oh my gosh, I love you. My dad, he doesn't say a whole bunch, you know, and dad's sort of on the side, like, there but not really there. I remember everyone looking really good. The women, whatever one layer of makeup they have on, they add like three more. Everyone has some heavy, what is that hairspray called? Aquanet? They got the tattooed eyebrows, some bright lipstick, sequin dresses. Everyone just trying to exude that aura like, hey, I'm still young and beautiful, just like how you remembered me. And we run into one of my mom's friends, and they're super excited to see each other. And my mom's friend is like, oh, this is my son Greenfield. And I'm like, well, that's a cool name. And his mom's like, he's named after the green fields in Vietnam. I'm like, whoa, yeah. And my mom's friend is like, I haven't seen you for so long. And she's like, yes. Wait, who are you? Like, she can't really remember who this person is. And she pulls out a photo and she's like, this is a photo of us in Vietnam. It's like, I look and it's the two of them in a black and white photo in their 20s. It was a funny thing walking through this party because everyone had like taken photos of an old photo of them younger so that they can kind of like re-identify the people in the party. So Greenfield's mom asked me to take a picture of the two of them, and they're smiling, holding each other, and Greenfield's mom's like, we used to be cellmates, in such a joyous way. And like, Greenfield and I look at each other and we're like, I have so many mixed emotions about this because that's really traumatic, but you are really happy. After everyone is fed and feels good, then Greenfield's mom turns to my mom and is like, hey, it's time for karaoke. She's like, so why don't you sing that one song? And she's like, what song? And she's like, the song you would always sing in jail, like every single day. My mom's nervous and looks over to the MC, and the MC hands her the mic, and she takes a breath, walks on stage, and begins to sing a song. So while she's singing the song, she's looking out, but she's really just looking at my dad and singing directly to my dad. So as my mom is singing, I get the sense that she's not really here. Like, in her mind, she has actually gone back in time, back to when she's in her jail cell. My mom's told me this story over and over, you know, since I was a kid. My parents' love story started in 1972. My mom's working in a bank as a bank teller. My mom was young. She was living in Saigon at the time. And then somebody she knew decided to set her up.
Hey, I want to introduce you a person. And it's a very nice person. And I said, okay. So after work, I went to my home. And she brought him over. And I look at him, I said, oh my God. I don't want... No, no. Because at first, the appearance, not exactly what I want.
When she first meets my dad, she's like, are you kidding me? Like, this dude? The thing you gotta know is, it's like, my mom wasn't just your average girl. My mom was kind of the She was beautiful and charming and had seven different guys trying to court her. She could have chose anybody.
And I told myself, nothing suitable for me. Go away.
So she sabotaged it from the beginning.
And I told myself, oh my God, I am going to give him something that he will never forget. That way he won't come anymore. Give him the tea from yesterday, cold tea.
Which is like basically the biggest diss you can give. There's no going back, yeah. Except she started to feel kind of bad.
And then because I was too nice, I said, we can be pen pal, okay? Yeah, and then he just wrote a letter.
I mean, these letters gave my dad a fighting chance.
Good handwriting. I said, wow, good.
Kind of opening doors between the two of them as they're sending them back and forth.
You develop your emotion together in the letter. And then in the letter, sometimes you write poems.
And all these letters, over time, they slowly win my mom over.
Good handwriting, and also he's hardworking, very low maintenance, and also he's willing to do things that I want him to do, you know.
So after 2.5 years, they get married, but they happen to fall in love at a very dangerous time. The Vietnam-American War had just ended, the communists had taken over, and there was just total instability everywhere. So my mom and dad decided the best chance at the life they wanted was to escape Vietnam together.
He said, we need to leave. And I said, how? He said, it's already arranged by his friend. Yeah.
My mom and dad leave from Saigon to the countryside, and it takes them like a day and a half to get out there. They change out of their city clothes and into countryside clothes, all black. And my dad's hidden a boat out there for them to escape. They decided to leave on a winter night. Just imagine leaving behind all your friends, your family, your whole country, just you and the love of your life.
And that's it. And just run. Because we want to have freedom. And also, at that time, I was young and just have the passion to go.
The men get on the boat first and they push off the beach. On board, there's these false floorboards for them to hide under just in case they get spotted. They sail down the coast to where the women are waiting, and that's where they gave him the signal. One of the men has a cigarette, and he's holding it up, and they can see the embers, so they see a light, light puff, like two inhales and an exhale. And when that comes, then the women know to jump on.
The boat is very, very, very small. 14 people. It was so small. It's very small. It cannot survive on the ocean.
I mean, the ocean was their only option. They took 14 people and they put them on the boat and they sailed down the coast into the sea. It was the gateway out of the country.
It's a very peaceful night, and the moon was very bright. And we were on the boat, on the sea. Very beautiful. And then that night is a silent night. December 24. And I sang Silent Night in Chinese and in English. And we were so happy. Yes. And then we thought we already passed the boundary. We were so happy when singing and everything.
There are few hours of quiet as they move through the dark water. They were near the border of Vietnam and almost had their first taste of freedom. And then they saw something approach.
A big boat. I don't know, because maybe people know that we're singing. I don't know. They told us to stop, but instead of stopping, they just put more gas on and they run faster.
they chased my mom and dad on the boat, and then they started shooting.
They shoot many, many bullets right where I was, underneath the boat.
Two people died on the boat that night, and the rest of the refugees, my mom and my dad, were taken in.
When we return, these mom and dad face the consequences. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Parent Trap episode. When last we left, after an attempt to escape from Vietnam fails, these mom and dad find themselves worse off than ever before. Snap Judgment.
After they were caught, they're put on a prison on an island called Gong Dao. So they separated the men from the women. My mom only knew that my dad was in a prison somewhere on that same small island. My mom always described her first night in jail vividly.
Very scary. Yeah. And no food, and dark, very dark, and cold.
She didn't like the food, and she made sure that everyone knew it.
When I look at the bowl of rice, I said, no, I don't want it. And then the person, he shut the door, and then he looked at me from the window. The window, it's only a slot, only show his eyes. And I was so scared, oh my God. And he said, see how long you can starve. The jail has nobody. The jail has at least 40 rooms, and we only have 5 people inside. And each person very far away. And you cannot talk with anybody. Sometimes I talk with ants on the floor. You have nothing to do. They make you just stay in the room. Nothing. Mm-hmm. And then I say, okay, let me sing.
She would sing the same song every day, several times a day.
The song described the sunset with beautiful color, and then two people holding hand together, walking on the beach, and happily watching the ocean and also the beautiful color of the sunset. And I told myself I like the song because I like to walk on this beach with my husband. So that's why I sing the song.
She used to sing it with her face towards the window, hoping my dad would hear.
I want to sing it loud so that my husband know where I am. I'm still alive. I don't know where he is, but I want to sing it loud so that someday he walk outside and he can hear me. That's why I sing so many times in a day.
When she sang to my dad, she imagined herself in the future with them, where they'd be together. My mom sang that song every day for 9 months until she got released. It turns out the women were released before the men, but my parents have their own version of the story.
He said that he also prayed that I can be released earlier.
They say that my mom got released earlier because my dad had made a deal with God that he would stay longer in prison if she got to go out first. She used to tell me that because of that, that's how she knew that he loved her.
He stayed there for me, that I know that he loved me.
A few months after my mom got out, my dad did too. It took him another 2 years to save up to escape Vietnam entirely, and eventually they made it to San Francisco. The first thing my mom wants to do when they get to San Francisco is hold hands and walk on the beach in their new home.
Yeah, we walk on the beach in San Francisco. It's different. It's so cold and you need to wear, oh my God, you need to wear the jacket.
It was a windy, cold day. It wasn't what she thought.
It's not the same as the song.
But my mom and dad were really close. And in the beginning of their life in the U.S., they were just as in love as ever.
Strong. Yeah, very strong. Because over here we build our family together.
They have this beautiful love song life, and then I think life kind of just happens, you know?
After 7 or 8 years.
They're just both, I think, just in that dirty grind of working and children and sending money back home. They're supporting everyone around them and didn't have anything else to give. There's a photo of the two of them that would sit in the foyer of our house where they're getting married, and they're in the car together, and they have, you know, white speckles of confetti all over them, and the both of them look just totally like that surprise smile, just caught in the moment, and they're both kind of like looking up at the camera. It's such a beautiful photo. They look like, for a moment, everything was just still. And so I think it became slowly and slowly over time, I think as I witnessed it, I've kind of forgotten about your love, and I've forgotten about, like, who you are. Growing up, it always felt like maybe at another time there was like a love, there was a passion, there was something deeper. I think what's also embedded in my memories too are, you know, pictures and home videos and stuff of them being happier. But I think their relationship that I witnessed growing up was pretty transactional. They stopped talking about their love story in the present tense, and then they started talking about it as something of the past.
When I sang the song, and I know that I was on the stage, but I feel like, oh, I was in jail. Mm-hmm. And I just imagine, get out of jail and go to the beach. I mean, inside that song.
So my mom's singing on stage and tears are streaming down her face, and she's looking straight at my dad the whole time. And the whole room sees them two looking at each other. I just looked over to my dad, and my dad had a blank stare.
When he saw me sing, and he kind of like, what's she singing? He doesn't feel the same feeling. I cry at the stage because I say, oh, how come it is different at that moment? And I want it to be the same. But I cannot because time already passed by.
My mom finishes the song and she walks down the stage and everyone's like handing her flowers and kind of like hugging and weeping with her. And she walks back to the table and sits down next to him. And everyone's like looking at him to see what he's reacting as or like what he's gonna say. And he kind of has this blank stare, not really responding. He just turned to her, gave her a napkin to wipe her tears, and patted her on the back. It's a weird thing to watch someone have no emotional reaction to someone else who had put out so much emotion. I guess I feel towards my mom that mixture of like sadness that she's holding on to it. I feel like seeing her through this, it's like she's always waiting for that romantic time that may never come. I don't think my dad really understood what was going on. I think also he doesn't romanticize things. That's sort of how he is. Like, my mom doesn't drive a car because she got in a car accident. My dad drives her everywhere. That's like, hey, I'm doing this act of service. I love you. And then she's like, well, you're just helping with my business. And he's like, well, what else did you ask for? You haven't asked me for anything else. And I think that's what makes me really sad, because it's like she has kind of this fantasy that isn't the reality or something that my dad will partake in. I think she knows that it's no longer in the jail cell or singing a song or that war story, you know? And so it's almost like she'll never be satisfied.
I think I need to start from the beginning. It's hard, yeah.
It's okay to start,
yeah,
from the beginning. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because long time I don't sing the song.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 夕阳一下时间又相惜, 留下了晚霞更艳丽, 晚风轻轻吹送到苍堤, 带来了一阵清凉意。 海面上也吹起不涟漪，和天边晚霞都艳丽。我们缓缓走向图画里，让晚霞照映在大地。
Big, special, huge thanks to V and her mom for sharing that story with us at Snap. The original score for that piece was by Pat Mesiti Miller. It was produced by Liz Mack. After the break, lockdown advice from people in places that you will not believe. Stay tuned. From Snap Judgment's Underground Remote Lair, welcome back to Snap, the Parent Trap episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and recently, Team Snap has been getting in touch with people from all over the world who've experienced some type of lockdown before. We want to bring you their advice to offer some comfort and some love during these strange times. So we proudly present another installment from our ongoing series, Letters from Lockdown. And we'll begin with Mansoor Daifi. Mansoor, he was detained at Guantanamo Prison for 15 years.
I am Mansoor Daifi from Yemen. I was detained at Guantanamo. Everything there at Guantanamo was designed to break you. We live in iron box, 2 meters and 2 meters. I think I will share my screen with you so I kind of would like to show, because here, can you see? In the photo here, it's 1 meter wide, okay? You have the bright light in this side. See, here the toilet, you have a little hole in the ground. Imagine you live here 24 hours. Bright light that will blow up your eyes. You are not allowed to know the time. You are not allowed to see the sun. You have nothing. Even your shorts can be taken from you at any moment. Even the smell of the air. They sometimes put like pepper spray in front of the air condition. Yeah, it just kills you. Anyway, I used to worry a lot, thinking a lot. Your life will never be the same. It's going to damage you mentally, psychologically, blah, blah, blah. You will live here. You won't be able to get any kids. You know, like, this, like, people have all kind of fears. Then one day I reached the conclusion, Mansoor, you have been worrying. You have been thinking a lot. You have been eating yourself inside out. So whether you cry, whether you hit your head against the ground, nothing is going to change. You know what? You know, you have a choice not to do. Like in Guantanamo, we managed not to take things seriously at all. We developed a sense of humor that it was so common among detainees. Even in the worst situation, like, you just try to make fun of each other. It's hard and difficult, but you have to make it look, you know, like, look funny. You know, like in 2004, they opened a new block called Romeo Block. It was one of the worst blocks at Guantanamo. As soon as they move us to the block, they strip us naked. I refuse. I'm not gonna give you my strip naked. They enter the cell. They, you know, hit our heads against the ground multiple times. They move me to the rec yard and they're like, they shaved both sides of my head and they leave only one line in the middle, like a horse. And they shaved my eyebrow. My face was really look ugly because it was swelling, it was bruising, it was like my like blue color around my eyes. Really, we looked very bad. And then the second day or third day, they came to move me to the solitary confinement. So when my brother saw me there, one of them said, "Who is this beautiful woman here?" It was like. It was just like, you know, someone would try to make like to make you happy. One of them said, "Mansoor, anytime I would like to scare one of the guards, please come to the window." It was painful. We were bleeding, but at the same time, we tried not to show it. At Guantanamo, you have nothing. But now, you live in your home. You have freedom. You know, you have a choice to be happy, choice to be sad, choice to be crazy, choice. Like, what distinguishes us from animals that we have free will. So even in the worst situation, we still choose the best way to live. It's not shame to be sad or to be mad, to be angry. No, let it out. But with other people, try to laugh, try to make them happy, try to give them hope, remind them, look, we will laugh after about it. I'm going to kick this our coronavirus. People will play games, maybe TV shows, maybe movies, maybe articles, who knows? This is humans. You know, sometimes ordeal can make you better, stronger, smarter, can change something in your life. You know, things get worse before they get better. It's not the end of the world. No, it's not. Maybe things will be slow, yes, but maybe it will be even better. This is what we told ourselves at Guantanamo.
You heard them, folks. Tell the funnies. Write them, share them. This is the season for dad jokes. Make fart noises. Wear your clothes inside out. Whatever keeps your crew laughing, do that. Now, our next piece of advice comes from Judy in Utah.
I'm Dr. Judy Elsley. I come from England, but I live in Ogden, Utah, in the U.S. I developed breast cancer. I was 59, and I was gone for about a year while I went through surgery, a mastectomy, and then chemo, which took a long time to recover from. And I would say that in many ways, what we're encountering now is parallel to my experience in that the whole world is sick at the moment. When I had breast cancer, I made 9 journal quilts. It was a time when I just didn't have the strength, inner or outer, to keep a journal and write about what was happening to me. But what I could do was cut out fabric, sew it together, and make an 8x8 inch square each day, and then just write the date on that square and write something that happened during that day, just a sentence or two. All right. I'll read you 2 early ones. The days drift by, a buffer until the real work begins, and the real work with the chemo. These days are calm and quiet, but I can hear the roar of the rapid, and I'm gradually floating towards it. The only way forward is through the rapid. Doing something creative every day is a real lifesaver for a number of reasons. One is that it gives shape and purpose to my day in a way that nothing else really does. I feel like I've achieved something even though nobody else may see it.
Snappers, I'm in my kitchen right now, learning how to grow hydroponic onions. At least, that's what I tell the kids they are. There is so much to do inside. Next up, are you tired of being locked in a small space with your special someone? When Meg and Elena, they found themselves having to escape Russia, they hopped on a boat and set sail, just the two of them. It took them 8 months on that boat before they arrived at their final destination, Canada. So you know, they know about a lockdown.
Hi, my name is Yelena, and I'm Russian.
And my name is Meg, and I am Canadian.
I think we are good people to talk to about this, because indeed, we spent many months in the confined space of the small sailboat.
We spent 10 months on the high seas without the right to land.
All we had was each other and the boat.
The first night we started out, we really didn't know how to sail. And we had left a country we could never go back to. And I had to come to grips with something because I was going to fall apart. That was the biggest problem right there, was the isolation, knowing that I was quite literally trapped and didn't have any place to turn. At that point in time, I had to sort of stand back and just put things one step in front of the other. And once we got through the first gale, we kind of got our sea legs, and we realized that we could look after ourselves. We were okay on our own. We could survive. And the next day was a little easier, and the next day was a little easier.
We have survived winter storms in North Pacific. We have survived pirates. We have survived hurricane in Atlantic. We have survived gales in Mediterranean. We have survived days and days and days of isolation and uncertainty.
Extreme isolation was one of the first things to get used to.
What else I was doing to fill the void in me was playing games, computer games. So the game I liked very much was Sims, because I could do things that I couldn't do in the middle of the ocean, like invite friends or watch television. And the ironic thing is that what I liked the most is preparing food, because there were appliances there, and all the sounds were real. All the sounds were the sounds of human life on land. It allowed me to be distracted from reality, from my fears, and it allowed me to put together 2 amazing worlds. I survive this uncertainty because I know that there is nothing else, that this life is it. I have to make every single day count.
That's right. Kids, let your folks know that video games are the least of their worries. I'm going to be playing Sims tonight. Next up, we hear from Eric Mwangwe. And back in the 1990s, Eric was a star goalkeeper of Rwanda's most beloved football team, Rayon Sport. And Eric was Tutsi. So when death squads started hunting Tutsis in the spring of 1994, Eric took refuge at his teammate's house. And his teammates were mostly Hutu, and they were playing the role of protector while Eric was hiding for his life.
For me and many people who were going through the crisis of 1994 genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda, the fear we had was real, was fear of surviving imminent death. My name is Eric Mwangwe Eugene, former Rwandan international footballer. In 1994, I was sitting in one house where I was with quite a few number of friends of mine, former teammates. We were quite a number of people, about 12 people in a three bedrooms house. My fear was constantly thinking about what might be coming, who might be coming to get me. There was fighting going on around us.
You can't describe it. We were used to random killings, random shootings, grenade being thrown here and there, continuous machine guns, all those kind of things. And it went on and on.
So in all this time, basically, my mind had completely become frozen because I wasn't thinking straight. To one point, I could not remember if it was 10 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, if it was Monday or Saturday. I could have broken down or something. Having people around you who was able to make you feel part of big group, big family, did help a lot to take away the anxiousness and the fear. We spent days talking to each other, playing cards and playing other games that would help them take their minds off what was going on around us. But having people around you, even though you knew they were not going to really stop a determined militia or soldier to take you away and kill you. The fact that they were there and you could trust him, you knew they could do everything to help me, and they did. They provided food, hope, all kind of things that I needed in that moment of needs. They were able to go out and look for food. If I had not been in that house, probably I would have died of hunger because I could not have gone out. So I think, the spirit of teamwork, struggling as a family, as a group, as a team, did help us a lot.
Call up with your fam, whoever you call fam, and love each other. Up next, we hear from a woman who grew up in an ultra-Orthodox Jewish community in Brooklyn.
If I was at home, I was either alone or taking care of the schedules and the needs of 8 children. It definitely kept me busy. But there was a lot of loneliness as well, and lonely hours. My name is Esti. I am a 55-year-old mother of 8 children. I grew up in Brooklyn, in the religious area of Brooklyn. I teach Zumba, Zumba Extreme, which is a wild form of Zumba, at the Jerusalem YMCA Sports Center. My isolation took place beginning in 1986 for approximately 2 decades. My abuser was my husband at the time. He basically supervised and controlled all my time, and he tried to control all my actions as well. I remember vividly this day. I bought myself this amazing rust-colored suede shirt. My ex took one look at me and said, "You're not leaving the house. You can't leave the house." I'm like, "Why?" He walked out the front door and locked me in. And first I banged on the door, and then I saw he walked away, and there was no use. I cried for a while, and I called him, and he wouldn't answer the phone. Anyway, looked around the apartment, and I said, "No problem." Changed to exercise clothing, took out my step, did a serious hour of step from my own head, made up my own routine, did a hell of an hour of step, and finished it, soaked to the bone, and I had power. I had total power. In that moment, I empowered myself, and it was okay for that moment. You have to find something you love. It doesn't make a difference what it is. You have to pick something that'll make you happy, that when you finish doing it, you'll close the book or close the video and you will smile and you'll feel good about yourself. And then you'll have a glass of wine and feel even better.
Don't worry, y'all. Bestie is now safe and sound. She recently married a fantastic man in Jerusalem, where she's still exercising in her apartment and teaching Zumba on Zoom. These stories were produced by Naomi Zeveloff, Shayna Sheely, Liz Mack, and Anna Sussman. It happened again. It happened again, I know. If you missed even a moment, get the amazing Snap Judgment podcast. Take it with you wherever you go. If you're out facing the world or you're inside distancing yourself from the world, storytelling, our storytelling is here to keep you company. Snap Storytelling is made possible by people just like you. So if you love Snap Stories, protect them. And if you like your stories, in the dark of night, we've got something for you. Spooked has returned. It's available right now at luminary.com. Amazing, true life, supernatural stories told firsthand by the people who can scarcely believe it happened themselves. Be afraid. Well, Snap is brought to you by the team that likes things just the way they were before all this nonsense. And no one is stronger in that sentiment than the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich, Pat Machini Miller, Anna Sussman, Renzo Gorio, John Facile, Shayna Sheely, Liz Mack, Marissa Dodge, Nika Singh, Elijah Smith, Lauren Newsom, Taylor Decott, Flo Wiley, Nancy Lopez, and Leon Morimoto. Wow, this is not the news. You know this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could pull a bunch of pranks on the evil girlfriend who your dad was about to marry, only for him to marry her anyway and give you one very, very, very upset stepmother. Oh no. All that, and he would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.